I'd like to begin by thanking Beth McGregor for the wonderful exhibit today, which do take time to look at it carefully. It's very inspiring, and for all the quiet and dedicated work she does to keep our archives together and safe and usable. This morning, we're going to celebrate our meeting house, this building, and what's happened in this building. Now, our first meeting house was a simple wooden building built in 1737. Our new congregation was, at that time, the second parish in Stoughton. Of this historic moment, the Reverend Samuel Dunbar wrote, July 23, this Lord's Day, about 30 families drew off from the public place of worship to ye new meeting house on ye plain at Massapog. In 1741, Reverend Dunbar made this notation, January 13, 1741. The pastor and deacons, ye delegates of ye church, assisted in ye ordaining council, and ordained Reverend Mr. Philip Curtis, pastor of ye church, in ye second precinct. So in 1741, we had a small meeting house, a minister who lived just a few doors down, the building's still there, and about 30 families. Reverend Curtis served the church for 55 years. During his pastorate, he officiated at 928 baptisms, 313 marriages, and 403 burials. By 1787, the congregation had outgrown the simple wooden meeting house, and a new one was constructed. Beth, who oversees our church archives, will tell us about that early meeting house.
We're not exactly sure where the first meeting house stood, but we know where the 1787 built meeting house stood, right here on this meeting house spot of land that was donated by Reverend Curtis to the church out of his own land holdings, right in the center of the village. He lived just up the street a bit. We know that it was oriented perpendicular to this one. And if you look at that etching, that engraving right here, you can see what it looked like. It was plain, traditional. It had a small cupola for a bell. They ordered a bell from London in 1790, but it cracked. So in 1811, the congregation traded it in to Paul Revere, who could melt it down and reuse it. He had a foundry nearby in Canton, and he cast a new one for $170. And that's the one with Paul Revere's name on it that still hangs up in our steeple. Now, families bought the enclosed square box pews. In fact, advance purchase of the pews helped finance the construction. We're going to build a new meeting house, buy your pew, put the money up front, and that'll help build the building. That's kind of a leap of faith. And these square pews, we have an old plan of the interior that's too big and too fragile for me to display, but the pews were arranged all around the edges and down the middle of the room, and the raised pulpit was on one of the long sides. And the old plan of the interior shows the names of the owners of the pews, and it's like a who's who of Sharon history, the names of all the streets and things like that. And we also have their names, including Deborah Sampson's, in the Bible that folks chipped in to buy in 1798. And their names are inscribed in the front, and it's actually open to the psalm that's going to be sung today. And that includes Deborah Sampson's name, among others, as Valerie mentioned. It's clear we didn't get many visitors because the chart shows only one unassigned box pew plus a row of seats designated for aged persons. And with the raised pulpit in the middle of one long side and everybody in the box pews all around, you faced each other in the box pews. You could sit on three sides. So thinking, what was it like to be the minister and half the congregation you can't see or has their backs to you or their sides? Perhaps it was easier to doze off that way when the minister couldn't see you. Like most New England meeting houses, this one was also used for town meetings and other civic purposes. And we know that the Declaration of Independence was read from the pulpit when it came out in 1776. In fact, with the blurring of lines of church and local government, it was actually a matter of some uncertainty for a century or more who actually owned the land. And we even had a little trouble coming up with documentation when we wanted the permits to build the new wing in 2010. We had to do some real digging. So that's a little bit about the first meeting house. Well, actually the second meeting house, the first on this site.
Now in the early 1800s, conflict arose in our congregation between those who were Trinitarians and those who were embracing this new Unitarian way of thinking. In 1813, after hearing a traveling Baptist preacher, a group of members withdrew to form a Baptist church in Sharon. It's right down the street. In 1821, another group left to form the Christian Society, which eventually became the First Congregational Church, which is right across the street. And this religious schism occurred throughout New England villages. It was the beginning of the Unitarian movement in this country. In 1825, the American Unitarian Association was formed, and soon afterwards, our church became identified as Unitarian. Unitarian Christianity focused on Jesus as a human being and on God as a loving spirit. And the test of your faith was in how you lived. It was in deeds, not creeds. Unitarians tended to take more liberal positions on social issues. The Unitarians in Sharon took an abolitionist stand against slavery, and they were also impacted by the Transcendentalist movement in New England. In 1842, the old meeting house was torn down, and our present meeting house was built, and Beth will speak now about our current and much-loved meeting house.
Well, in 1842, the Unitarians dismantled the old meeting house, but they were good recyclers. They salvaged everything they could for reuse. And if you go up in the attic, you can see the original beams notched, hand-notched in different places where they were originally connected in 1787. So one can see why they might need some reinforcement. They're kind of old. It's some old wood holding us up. And they built this meeting house for good practical reasons. The original building was antiquated, and it was too large now that the church's church-going population was divided among at least three congregations, and probably not quite as diligently church-going as they'd been 100 years before. But I also think the builders of our meeting house had a vision. They wanted something beautiful, something neoclassical, that expressed the spirit of the Enlightenment rather than the spirit of old New England Calvinism. And that's what they built at a cost, we have the bill, of $2,540, which then was a lot of money. This new meeting house also had the advantage of a separate space for social gatherings, meetings, and educations, the vestry down below. The vestry had a beautifully fitted wood floor that I still remember of narrow boards, smooth enough that among its many other uses, it was used as a roller skating rink in the late 1800s. A lot of people must have bumped into those poles. But unfortunately, the floor was laid on split logs over bare earth, and dampness, rot, buckling, and then an invasion of termites meant that we had to rip it out and pour a more solid foundation for our church. And Colleen, the termite queen, can tell. She was the construction worker on that project. You could ask her about it in the late 80s, around 1990. So although it was no longer officially the town's meeting house, this church, this building, continued to be used for many public functions, including some town meetings. I put up a town meeting notice from the 1870s there. lots of civic groups, artistic events, and even as an overflow public school classrooms for a while. And Temple Sinai got its start meeting here. It's obviously grown since then. The vision of being there to serve and welcome the whole town persisted despite the split and with the new meeting house, and it still persists, as we know. Over the last 173 years, this building, this meeting house, has been well-loved and well-cared for by generations who've put their time, their treasure, and their sweat equity into it. When you're next in the library, I invite you to check out the glass display cabinet for some stories of this. For instance, when the old hot air furnace in the vestry exploded in 1950, literally, nobody was hurt, fortunately, it was on a weekday, the church members put in most of the labor to build an outside furnace room, install a new furnace, and piping, this same piping that you hear knocking on cold mornings. And they did it all in about 2 weeks so that church wasn't interrupted. To house a growing religious education program, in 1960, members donated their money, their skills, and lots of just plain hard labor to build a new religious education wing. Beverly Kinraid remembered being out there working with her whole family, digging and so forth. It was a no-frills but functional space that cost about $5,000 to build. Now, as the time progressed through the latter part of the past century, we found creative ways to shore up the very precarious steeple and to rehang the Revere bell so that it could ring again. And our ideas included turning our sanctuary into the Hall of the Continental Congress for repeated performances of the musical 1776. You can ask Alan Post, AKA Thomas Jefferson, all about that effort. We have, if you look in the library, we have pictures of him very precariously up working on patching the steeple. So he was multitasking, shall we say. For years, we've patched, we've plastered, we've painted, we've somehow held it all together, sometimes with duct tape. We've always found a way to preserve this historic, this deeply spiritual place that we are the lovers and custodians of.
During the 1800s, 14 ministers served this congregation. The final one in the 19th century was Reverend Eliza Hickok, the first woman minister at the meeting house. It was rare in those days for any church to hire a woman minister. Reverend Hickok was a progressive thinker, earnest and outspoken in the cause of social justice. In the early 20th century, the congregation became small. At one point, there were only 6 members. However, as Sharon grew in population, the church began to grow in membership. In 1961, when the Unitarian denomination merged with the Universalist denomination, we became the Unitarian Church of Sharon, a member of the Unitarian Universalist Association. The congregation shifted in the 20th century from being a liberal, Unitarian Christian community to being a pluralistic congregation where diverse belief systems were welcomed, where you could be atheist, theist, agnostic, you could self-identify as Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, pagan, whatever. Open theologically, a big change in the 20th century. As Beth spoke, we had devoted members who repaired the meeting house, conducted worship services, hired very part-time ministers. We began using a chalice, a symbol of the Unitarian tradition around the world, and we added our church covenant. And then the church took a bold step. They said, it's time for us to grow. And they hired the Reverend Deborah Kerr as an extension minister, which meant it was partly funded by the Unitarian Universalist Association. She served from 1996 to 2008, and we grew from 90 members to 120. And it was at that moment, at the close of her ministry, the congregation was ready to embark on a most amazing adventure called the AIM project, which Beth will speak about.
AIM is, of course, an acronym. It stands for Accessibility and Improvements to the Meeting House. It all started with accessibility. We were troubled that elders and people with mobility impairments found it difficult or even impossible to be a full part of our community. I remember four men carrying the wheelchair of Don Brookfield, a longtime faithful member, up the stairs to the sanctuary so he could be there for his wife's memorial service. We knew that wasn't right. So we began looking at elevators. All right, we'll get an elevator. But that had its problems, and at the same time, our religious education program was growing, and we were feeling pressure for space for it, and adding an elevator wouldn't help that, and it would actually cut some more space out of our already tight space. And the basically home-built 1960 RE wing also had its problems, like dampness and periodic flooding. Sometimes it felt like my wet vac and my box fans actually lived at church and I just borrowed them back occasionally. It couldn't keep up with our growing congregation and our dynamic RE program, so the vision grew. It was a long process. We began carefully, communally, inclusively envisioning, what do we really need? What are we really called to do? How can we find a way to do it? Many, many meetings, many, many discussions involving all ages. The AIM committee, chaired by Linda Godfrey Bailey, was born, and it worked, and it worked, and it worked. There is a whole saga to be told about the AIM process that deserves another time and another cast of speakers to tell it, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point. The stewardship committee set to work at the daunting task of making our resources match our vision, and they raised $1.3 million, which was considerably more than the professional fundraising consultants thought we could do. We had setbacks. We had to change architects. We had to delay our building plans for a year while we raised more money, and that actually worked to our advantage because it was a recession, and the contractors were hungrier, and the prices were lower. And Jack Armstrong and Gare Reed found themselves in transition points in their lives, which freed them up to become the construction managers. And they pretty much moved into here they went home at night, but you know, they were here. So finally, we had to, first, 2009 was a really tough year because we had to tear down the old wing before we could build the new one. And everything had to be packed up in boxes. And you could ask Frank Salvatore about how many boxes were schlepped back and forth to remote storage. We were back to the same amount of space we had in 1842, where the meeting house was built for a lot more people and programs than they had back then. We rented office space in the Congregational Church. We had religious education space in the town library. There was a tremendous amount of schlepping that went on for a good year. But we got through it intact, in good spirits, still whole as a community, and ready to celebrate the dedication of a beautiful and environmentally responsible new wing in May of 2010. We did it.
So who are we today? We have 186 members, 95 children and youth. We have a church school that is vibrant. Worship services are inspiring. We have programs all week long in our new addition. We're united in our spiritual values, which we express in our covenant, while we enjoy a wide diversity of theological and religious beliefs. We are active in social justice and interfaith work, and our members help each other in so many quiet and important ways. We are a meeting house, a house where people with different religious viewpoints meet to celebrate life, affirm important values, raise our children together, work to change the world, and support one another. We are in our 278th year, and we are full of enthusiasm. And yet, our meeting house is tired. The pews are old and unstable. The walls have cracks. The windows are not energy efficient. The electric wiring is old. The AV, audiovisual IT system is archaic. The building is sound, but it needs some love. And that is why we are embarking on an AIM 2 project to make our beloved meeting house fit for the next 50 years. My friends, this is your meeting house. It belongs to you. It is your love, interest, enjoyment, dedication, enthusiasm, inspiration, volunteering, and yes, financial giving, which makes the Unitarian Church of Sharon, this beautiful meeting house and all that happens in it, such a life-affirming community. Thank you. I invite you to join now in a time of meditation. Sit comfortably with your eyes open or closed as you wish. And I invite you in the next few minutes to imagine, to visualize in your mind's eye the history of this meeting house. Imagine the year is 1737. Visualize farmland, pastures, woods all around you with just a few buildings and a dirt road. Now imagine a simple, small wooden meeting house and a handful of people coming to attend it. It is our beginning. People coming for hope, support, community, love, and joy. Now imagine it is 1800. Now see a very small village around you. And imagine on the same spot a large wooden meeting house. And you go inside that meeting house and see the wooden box pews. Imagine going into one of the family pews and sitting there. The meeting house is filled. People coming for hope, support, community, love, and joy. Now imagine it is 1900. It is now a small town, and you are sitting inside our current meeting house, maybe in the very pew you're sitting in now. But as you look around, there's only 12 people in church. Oh, this small band is holding the community together. They are coming for hope and support, for love and for joy. And now it is today, and you are sitting here. The meeting house is filled with enthusiastic people. And we have been given the gift of this historic meeting house. And like all the ancestors, we gather for hope, support, community, love, and joy. May we be joyful stewards of this historic meeting house. Amen.